even as the airship is pulling all of their weights. The other reason that she wants to work is to take her mind off what is going on down below, or up above, depending on perspective. The sudden silence of the messenger has affected them all. Reason dictates that their mission is no more than peripherally connected, in that both events involve the erratic brilliance of Bianca. But like humans, the spiders are quick to see patterns and make connections, to extract untoward significance from coincidence. There has been a curious anxiety about the crew, for all that those glory days of Temple are long gone. Being this much closer to the essential mystery of the messenger, and so cut off from all they know, arouses strange thoughts. At last, Viola is confident that the Sky Nest will coast stably in the thin air, and she liaises with radio beacons on the ground. The air currents, that have been mapped out crudely over the last few years, are carrying them closer to the crisis point. "Portia, Fabian, go to your station," she orders. Portia questions her respectfully, signalling with terse passes of her palps that she feels the mission could be achieved single-handed as easily as it could with two. It is not a lack of faith in Fabian's abilities that moves her, but a fear for him. Males are so frail, and she feels protective. Viola indicates that everything will proceed according to the plan, and that plan calls for two of them to enter the smaller craft mounted atop the Sky Nest. The Star Nest, they call it. And it will carry them where no spider has ever been, into regions that have been the province of myth and imagination since their records began. Some small, unpiloted vessels have coasted close to that boundary. Now the scientists believe they have come to an understanding of the conditions at the very edge of the world's reach, and have planned accordingly. Portia and Fabian will have to wrestle with the truth of their beliefs, and they go as a pair, in case one of them should fail. The Sky Nest is robust, able to survive the hectic and turbulent weather conditions extending all the way down to the surface of their world. It is still a great, almost weightless object, a cloud of silk and wood and hydrogen. A small crew of spiders and a handful of engines are the heaviest things aboard. Still, it is not light enough. When fully inflated, the Star Nest will be a reasonable fraction of the Sky Nest's size, and carry a much smaller fraction of its weight, a truncated onboard colony to handle life support, a radio, two crew, the payload. This is one of the things that Bianca and her peers have discovered, that there is a tapering edge to the sky, that the air diminishes as a traveller grows more distant from their world, thinner and colder and more unreliable until, well, there remains some disagreement as to whether it actually ends, or whether it simply grows so rarefied that no instrument exists able to detect it. How many molecules of air in a square kilometre of space constitute a continuation of the atmosphere, after all? Portia makes her way to the robing chamber, to be fitted into her suit. This is not simply an insulating covering, such as the sailors have worn, but a cumbersome and curious outfit that is bulky about the joints and bloated about the abdomen, where the air tanks are housed. At the moment it is depressurized and hangs flaccid about her, feeling surprisingly heavy, interfering with her movements and making a mumble out of her attempts to speak. On this mission, she will be reduced to palp signals and radio. Fabian joins her, similarly caparisoned. He flicks her an encouraging gesture to keep her spirits up. He has been chosen as her second because they work well together, but also because, small even for a male, he is half her size and less than half her weight. The Star Nest has a long way to haul them. After all, the stars are very far away. Even the messenger is far away, passing across the sky far higher than the Star Nest could ever reach. Philosophical quibbles aside, there is no atmosphere there at all. The messenger is a form of life dwelling in the harshest, most life-negating environment a spider can imagine. And Portia cannot help wondering, have we silenced her by reaching as high as we are? Are we measuring legs with her by simply doing so? The crew cabin of the Star Nest is terribly cramped. The ceiling is swollen with the airship's systems. Its heater, chemical factory, transmitter, receiver, and a population of ants of limited capacity, dedicated only to keeping it all running. Portia and Fabian settle themselves as best they can, nestling into the limited give that the walls allow them. The radio pulses the instructions from Viola, back in the long crew compartment of the Skynest, putting Portia through a long series of checks, cross-referenced with the reports of both vessels on board colonies that are in any event mother and daughter, which kinship aids in linking communications between the colonies. Viola signals that the crisis moment is reached. Given best estimations of air current movement, this is when the craft must separate for the Starnest to obtain the optimum chance of success. Viola's words, transmitted as electronic pulses that strip the information of all the sender's character and personality, sound dreadfully efficient. Portia responds that she and Fabian are ready for separation. Viola starts to say something, then stills the words. Portia knows that she has just reined in some platitude concerning the messenger's goodwill. Such sentiments seem inappropriate just at this moment. Down on the surface, dozens of observatories and radio receivers are awaiting developments, agog. Starnest has been clinging to the upper surface of Skynest's gas bag like a benign parasite. Now its crew have effected the climb to it and set themselves in place. It is detached gently by the Skynest ants, a host of tiny lines severed, so that all at once the Starnest's superior buoyancy tells, and it floats free of the mothership with jellyfish-like grace. Immediately it ascends higher than the more robust vehicle could follow, caught in the upper air currents, holding, for now, to the models of its movements set out by scientists who are not having to trust their own lives to the thing. Portia and Fabian make regular radio reports back to Viola and the wider world. In between, they mostly amuse themselves. Their ability to communicate is limited to pulp signalling, any greater subtlety being stifled by their close quarters and the cumbersome suits. The cold is infiltrating, despite the layers of silk cosseting the crew compartment. They are already breathing stored air, which is a limited resource. Portia is aware that there is a strict timetable by which their mission must be fulfilled. The chemical light of her instruments tells her of their swift ascent. The radio confirms the Starnest's position. Portia feels that curious sensation that is so much of what she is. She is walking where no other has walked. This sense of opportunistic curiosity that has been with her ancestors since they were tiny, thoughtless huntresses is strong in her. For Portia, there is always another horizon, always a new path. It is around this time that the messenger breaks radio silence. Portia is not tuned to God's frequency, but the tumultuous response from the ground tells her what has happened. She herself is not fluent in God's difficult, counterintuitive language, but translations come through swiftly, passing across the face of the planet as swift as thought. God has apologized. God has explained that she has previously misunderstood some key elements of the situation, but has now gained a clearer understanding of how things are. God invites questions. Portia and Fabian, locked in their tiny ascending bubble, wait anxiously to hear what will be said. They know that Bianca and her fellows on the ground must be feverishly debating what comes next. What question can possibly mark the start of this new phase of communication with the messenger? But of course, there is only one vital question. Portia wonders if Bianca will actually canvass anyone else's opinion in the end, or whether she will simply send off her own demand to God to prevent anyone else doing likewise. It must be a grand temptation to every other spider with access to a transmitter. What Bianca asks is this. What does it mean that you are there and we are here? Is there meaning? Or is it random chance? Because what else does one ask, even a broken cybernetic deity? But why are we here? From her high vantage point, Dr. Avrana Kern readies herself to make full disclosure. Here is a question she can answer in more detail than all the spiders in the world could ever want. She, Avrana Khan, is history itself. She takes the equivalent of a deep breath, but no answers come to mind. She is replete with the assurance that she knows, but such confidence is not backed by the knowledge itself. The archive of data that she thinks of as my memories is unavailable. Error messages leap out when she seeks the answers. It is gone. That trove of what once was has gone. She is the only witness to a whole age of mankind, yet she has forgotten. The unused records have been overwritten in her thousands of years of sleep, in her centuries of waking. She knows she knows, and yet in truth she does not know. All she has is a patchwork of conjecture and memories of times when she once remembered the things she can no longer recall firsthand. If she is to answer the planet, it will be with those pieces stitched together into a whole cloth. She will be giving them belated creation myths, high on dogma, but low on detail. But they are so desperate to know, and it is the right question. Would she have them ask for technical specifications or serial numbers? No. They must know the truth, as best as she can tell it. So she tells them. She asks them what they think those lights in the sky are. Those below are astronomers enough to know that they are unthinkably distant fires. They are like your sun, she says. And around one such was a world much like your own, on which other eyes looked up at those distant lights and wondered if anything looked back down. She has slipped into the past tense naturally, although her concept of a linear past is a little at odds with the spider's own concepts. Earth itself is dead to her. The creatures that lived on that world were quarrelsome and violent, and most of them strove only to kill and control and oppress each other, and resist anyone who tried to improve the lot of their fellows. But there were a few who saw further. They travelled to other stars and worlds, and when they found a world that was a little like their own, they used their technology to change it until they could live upon it. On some of these worlds, they lived, but on others, they conducted an experiment. They seeded those worlds with life and made a catalyst to quicken that life's growth. They wanted to see what would emerge. They wanted to see if that life would look back at them and understand. Something moves within what is left of Avrana Khan, some broken mechanism she has not used for such a long, long time. But while they were waiting, the destructive and wasteful majority fought with the others, the right thinkers, and started a great war. She knows now that her audience will understand war and catalyst and the bulk of the concept she is using. And they died. They all died. All the people of Earth save just a few. And so they never did come to see what grew on their new-made worlds. And she does not say it, but she thinks, and that is you. My children, it is you. You are not what we wanted. Not what we planned for, but you are my experiment, and you are a success. And that jagged-edged part moves once again, and she knows that some part of her, some locked-away fleshy part, is trying to weep. But not from sorrow, rather from pride. Only from pride. In her tiny, insulated world, Portia listens to what God has to say and tries to assimilate it, as other spider minds across the world must also be trying to grasp what is being said. Some of it is incomprehensible, just as so much of the messenger's message is. But this is clearer than most. God is really trying to be understood this time. She asks the next question almost simultaneously with Bianca. So you are our creator? With all the baggage that comes with it. Made why? For what purpose? And the messenger responds, you are made of my will, and you are made of the technology of that other world. But all of this has been to speed you on a path you might have taken without me. given time and opportunity. You are mine, but you also belong to the universe, and your purpose is whatever you choose. Your purpose is to survive and grow and prosper and to seek to understand, just as my people should have taken these things as their purpose, had they not fallen into foolishness and perished. And Portia, for all that she was never a temple-goer, feels that she, as she ascends into the sparse reaches of the upper air, is fulfilling that very mandate in pushing the frontiers of understanding. Their ascent has been rapid. God has been long-winded. They are slowing now, and the colour of the altimeter suggests that even the tenacious star nest, which is merely a thin skin around a great mass of hydrogen from which dangles a very little weight, is reaching its ceiling, out where the atmosphere is almost nothing, and therefore there is nothing for the light gas to be lighter than. They are still far, far short of the orbiting messenger, barely a third of the distance to that distant spark, but this is as far as they themselves can go. Their payload, however, is intended to go further. Deploying it is the riskiest part of a risky journey out here where no spider was ever intended to travel. Portia will be sending into orbit the first ever artificial object originating on her world. The spiders have built a satellite. It is a double-hulled glass ball containing a radio transmitter receiver and two colonies, one of ants, one of algae. The algae is a special breed cultivated by the sea-going stomatopods, designed to adjust its metabolism to regulate the proportions of the surrounding environment. It will flourish in the sunlight, expanding into the hollow silk veins that the satellite will spread, and regulated by the ant colony who will feed on it as well as breathe its oxygen. The satellite is a tiny biosphere, intended to last perhaps a year before falling out of balance in some way. It will act as a radio relay, and the ants can be conditioned from the ground to perform a number of analytical tasks. In respect of its capabilities, it is not revolutionary, but in what it represents, it is the dawn of a new era. It is intended to detach itself from beneath the gondola where it has been hanging as the single densest part of the star nest expedition. It has chemical rockets to push it that little step further into a stable orbit, the ants already pre-armed with the calculations they will need to adjust its trajectory as it flies. Despite their chemical expertise, the spiders have a limited ability to produce combustion-based rockets, hence the entire Skynest, Starnest project. Kern and her people never considered this, but life on the green planet is young by geological standards, too young to have produced anything in the way of fossil fuels. Biotechnology and mechanical ingenuity have had to take up the slack. The payload is not detaching. Portia registers the fact dully. She and Fabian are weathering the conditions only with difficulty. The long, cold ascent has taken a great deal out of them both. As a species, they are inefficient endotherms. By now both of them are ravenously hungry, consuming their internal food stores yet still growing sluggish with the cold. Now something has gone wrong, and Portia must leave the crew cabin and go out into the vanishingly thin air to see if it can be rectified. The danger is increasing every moment. If it is the satellite that has malfunctioned, it may try to fire its rockets without detaching from the star nest, which would shrivel away the cabin and then ignite the hydrogen cells. Fabian informs the ground of their situation, breaking into the general babble that the messenger's revelations have sparked off. Bianca and her peers, those directly involved in the star nest project, quieten down rapidly. Communication is difficult. Fabian repeats himself over and over as Portia prepares her suit for exit into the hostile near space around them. The star nest's transmitter is having difficulties reaching as far as the planet's surface, another piece of technology creaking under the strain. Portia positions herself where she intends to exit, near the bottom of the crew cabin. She spools out a safety line attached to the cabin interior, then spins a second wall over herself, before sealing her spinnerets inside her suit. Then she cuts her way out of the cabin and into the space between the hulls. Next, repairs the rip left behind her, and then performs the same procedure again to let herself out into the killing cold of beyond. Her suit inflates instantly, her internal air supply reacting to the thin atmosphere and expanding, mostly about her abdomen, mouth, eyes and joints, those parts which might suffer from a sudden loss of pressure. Portia has several advantages over a vertebrate right now. Her open circulation is less vulnerable to frostbite and to gas bubbles caused by changes of pressure, and her exoskeleton retains fluids more readily than skin. Even so, the inflated suit reduces her movement to a crippled shuffle. Worse, she starts to heat up almost immediately. She has just been able to keep her body temperature up, but she has no ready way to bring it down. The heat that she is generating has nowhere to go, being surrounded by so little air. She begins the slow process of boiling within her own skin. She crawls painfully down to find the satellite, seeing through her filmy viewport that it is glued to the hull with ice. She has no way of communicating this to anyone, and can only hope that the payload itself is still functioning. Grimly, she begins chipping and cutting at the ice with her forelimbs. Still, the glass sphere remains anchored to the silk of the star nest. Portia is distantly aware that its rockets may trigger at any moment and will likely burn up the entire star nest before melting the ice. Even as this thought fights its way into her broiling mind, she sees the first dull glow, a mixing of chemicals giving rise to sudden heat. This is her job. This is why they chose her. She is a pioneer, a risk-taker, a spider never satisfied with simply sitting and waiting for the world to come to her. She is a hero, but one more envied than emulated. She clumsily enfolds the satellite and succeeds in finally wrenching it away from its icy holdfast. Bunching her rear legs, she takes aim into clear space and puts everything she has into one grand jump. She feels her suit rip about one of her rear legs, the sudden leap having been more than the stressed silk can take. The chill that now seizes the exposed limb is almost welcome. Then she is springing out and into the thin, thin air, out and arcing downwards towards the patient pull of the planet beneath them. With a spasmodic motion of six limbs, she throws the satellite away from her. Its rockets flare. The extreme edge of their fiery tail singes her as the satellite corkscrews madly away, under and out from the overreaching canopy of the star nest. She has no idea if it will be able to correct its course enough to make the intended orbit. In her mind arises the surprisingly rational thought, there must be an easier way than this. Then she is falling and falling, and although her legs go through the stuttering motions of spinning a parachute, she creates nothing. Her descent comes to a sudden, jolting stop, dangling beneath the star nest. Her safety line has caught her. But it doesn't matter. The air in her suit is depleted, and she is too hot now to move or think. She gives herself up for lost. Fabian is already at work by this time. He has followed very little of what has gone on, but the sudden pull on Portia's line alerts him, and he follows it out, self-made airlock by airlock, until, his own suit puffed out and constricting, he can haul her up. With what feels like the last of his strength, he is able to roll her inside, and then uses his fangs to tear open both their suits once the cabin is resealed. He lies there on his back, limbs tangled with Portia's. She is not moving, save for a shallow pulsing of her abdomen. Somehow, he reaches the radio transmitter, sending a semi-incoherent report of their situation. He catches a faint confirmation that the satellite has been successfully deployed, but no indication that they have heard him. He tries again, sends gibberish with shaking palps, and eventually manages, "Can you receive me? Can anybody receive me?" Nothing from the ground. He does not even know if the radio is working now. He is desperately hungry, and Portia's extravehicular excursions mean that they have very little air left. He has initiated venting of the hydrogen, as swift as is safe, but there is still a long way to go down. He and Portia do not have either the energy or the oxygen to reach hospitable altitudes. Then the voice comes. Yes, I receive you. The messenger is listening. Fabian feels a religious awe. He is the first male ever to speak with God. I understand your position, the messenger tells him. I cannot help you. I am sorry. Fabian explains that he has a plan. He spells his scheme out carefully. Can you explain to them all? That I can do, the messenger promises. And then, with a sudden access of old memory, when my ancestors reached for space, there were deaths among those pioneers too. It is worth it. The next phrase is alien to Fabian. He will never know what was meant by, I salute you. He turns to Portia, who has nothing more left to give. She lies on her back, senseless, stripped of everything but her most basic reflexes. With slow, difficult movements, Fabian begins to court her. He moves his palps before her eyes and touches her, as if he were seeking to mate, triggering slow instinct that has been built over by centuries of civilization but has never quite gone away. There is no food to restore her, save one source. There is not enough air for two, but perhaps sufficient for one. He sees her fangs unclench and lift, shuddering. For a moment he contemplates them and considers his regard for this crewmate and companion. She will never forgive him or herself, but perhaps she will live nonetheless. He gives himself up to her automatic embrace. Later, Portia returns to consciousness aboard the Skynest, feeling gorged, damaged, strangely sensual. She has lost one rear leg entirely, and two sections of another limb, and one of her secondary eyes is out. She lives, though. When they tell her what Fabian did to secure her survival, she refuses to believe it for a long time. In the end, it is the messenger herself who brings her to an acceptance of what happened. Portia will never fly again, but she will be instrumental in planning further flights, safer and more sophisticated methods of reaching orbit. For now that the messenger has found the patience and perspective to properly understand her children, she can finally communicate her warning in a way they can understand. At last, the spiders appreciate that, even aside from their orbiting god, they are not alone in the universe, and that this is not a good thing. Part 7. Collision. Chapter 7.1. War Footing. They were packed into the briefing room. It was like déjà vu, but these days that seemed a good thing. Holston was a citizen of a tiny world of cycles and repetitions, and where events failed to repeat themselves, it meant deterioration. Some of the lights were out, and that really brought it home to him. All the miracles of technology that had made the Gilgamesh possible, all the tricks they had stolen from the gods of the old empire, and right now they either couldn't get all the lights working, or there were simply too many higher priority things to be doing. He recognised a surprising number of faces. This was clearly a command meeting. These were key crew, or who was left of them. He saw the science team, a handful of engineering, command, security, all people who had got on board when Earth was still a place where humans lived. These were people who had been granted custodianship over the rest of the human race, with some notable omissions. The only department chief present, assuming you discounted Holston himself and his department of one, was Vitas, orchestrating the bleary, recently awoken muster. ordering people according to some idiolectic system of her own. There were a handful of young faces in old ship suits helping her, Lane's legacy, Holston guessed. They could have passed for the mob that he remembered from so recently, but he guessed they must be at least a generation further on from that. They had persevered, though. They had not turned into cannibals, or anarchists, or monkeys. Even that fragile appearance of stability gave him some hope. "Classicist Mason, there you are!" It was hard to say what Vitas felt about seeing him present. Indeed, it was hard to say what she felt about anything. She had aged, but gracefully, and only a little, it seemed. Holston found himself indulging in the bizarre speculation that she was not human at all. Perhaps she was her own self-aware machine. Controlling the medical facilities, she would be able to hide her secret forever, after all. He had seen a lot of mad things since setting foot on the Gilgamesh, but that would have been a step too far. Even the old empire, unless she was old empire, some anachronistic 10,000-year survival, fusion-driven and eternal. Finding himself momentarily adrift from reason, he grasped for Vitas's hand and snagged it, feeling the human warmth, willing himself to trust to his own perceptions. The scientist raised her eyebrows sardonically. "Yes, it's really me," she remarked. "Amazing, I know. Can you use a gun?" "I very much doubt it," Holston blurted out. "I... what?" "The commander wanted me to ask that of everyone. I had already guessed the answer in your case." Holston became cold and still all at once. The commander. Vitas watched him with dry amusement, letting him hang in suspense for a few long seconds before explaining. "Lem Karst is the acting commander, for your information." "Karst?" Holston felt that was hardly better. How bad has it got that Karst gets to call the shots? There were a lot of looks from the rest of key crew at that remark, some frowning, others plainly sharing his opinion, including even one of the security team. It was a rare moment when Holston would far rather be in the minority. "We're travelling into the Kern system," Vitas explained. She turned to the console behind her, gesturing for Holston's attention. "Not to put too fine a point on it, but once we're in orbit around the Green Planet, the Gilgamesh's wandering days are likely to be done." The oddly poetic turn of phrase gave her clipped tones an unexpected gravitas. "Lane's tribe have done a remarkable job in keeping him together, but it really has been damage control, quite literally, and the damage has begun to win. There's quite a population of shipborne now, because the suspension chambers are failing beyond the point of repair. Nobody's going to be heading off on another interstellar jaunt."
"Which means..."
"Which means there's only one place left for us all, yes, Mason." Mutus's smile was precise and brief. "And we're going to have to fight the old empire for it."
"You seem to be looking forward to it," Holston observed.
"It's been the goal of a long, long plan, Mason, on centuries in the making. The longest of long games in the history of our species, except for whatever that Kern thing has been doing. And you were right, in a way, about the commander. He's not here to see it, but it's Guyen's plan. It was so from the moment he set eyes on that planet."
"Guyen?"
Holston echoed. "He was a man with a vision," Vitas asserted. "He cracked under the strain at the end, but given what he'd gone through, that's hardly surprising. The human race owes him a great deal." Holston stared at her, remembering how she had treated the disastrous upload of Guyen's mind as some sort of hobby experiment. In the end, he just grunted, and something of his feelings were plainly visible on his face, judging by the scientist's reaction. "Karst and some of the tribe have jury-rigged a control center in the comms room," Vitas said, somewhat coldly. "Your key crew, so he'll want you there. Alpash?" One of the young engineers appeared at her elbow. "This is Alpash. He's shipborne," Vitas explained, as though excusing some congenital defect. "Get Mason here, and the rest of key crew, up to the commander, Alpash." She spoke to the young man as though he was something less than human, something more like a pet or a machine. Alpash nodded warily at Mason. If Vitas was his exemplar for key crew, he probably didn't expect much in the way of manners. There was a distinct skittishness about him as he gathered up the recently woken engineers, security men and the like. It reminded Holston of the way that Guyon's cultists had treated him. He wondered what legends of key crew had Alpash been brought up on. Over in comms, Karst looked refreshingly the same. The big security chief had been given the time to get some stubble going on his ravaged face, and he had obviously not been wheeled out much since Holston last saw him, because he had barely aged. As the surviving key crew filed in, he grinned at them, an expression equally of anticipation and strain.
"Come in and find a seat, or stand, whatever you like. Vitas, can you hear me?"
"I hear,"
the science chief's voice crackled and spat from an unseen speaker.
"I'll continue to supervise the unpacking, but I'm listening."
Karst grimaced, shrugged.
"Right."
He turned to address them all, looking from face to face. When he met Holston's eyes, there was none of the expected dislike. Gone was any hint that the security man had never much cared for Holston Mason. Absent, too, was the expected air of dismissal, that of a man of action who had no use for the man of letters. Instead, Karst's grin dwindled to a smaller but much more sincere smile. It was a look of things shared, a commonality between two people who had been there right at the start and were still here now.
"We're going to fight," the security chief told them all. "We've basically got just one good chance at it. You all know the score, or you should do. There's a satellite out there that can probably rip open the gill in a blink if we give it the chance. Now, we bolted on some sort of diffusion shielding back when we were pirating that terraforming station. Some of you maybe weren't awake for that, but there's a summary in the system of the changes we made. We also hardened our computer systems, so that bitch, so the satellite, can't just shut us down or open the airlocks, that sort of trick. We've taken every precaution, and I still reckon toe-to-toe, we might be screwed."
He was grinning again, though.
"But I've had some drones fitted out in the workshops. They've got shielded systems as well, and lasers that I think can burn the satellite. That's the plan, basically. Best defence is a good offence, and so on. As we come in towards our orbit, we burn the fucker up and hope it's enough. Otherwise, it's down to using the Guild's forward array, and that puts us within range of retaliation."
He paused, then finished.
"So you're probably wondering what the fuck I need with all of you guys, yeah?"
Holston cleared his throat.
"Well, Vitas asked me if I could use a gun. I appreciate I'm no great tactician, but if it comes to needing that against the satellite, we've probably already lost."
Karst actually laughed.
"Yeah. Well, I'm planning ahead. Planning to win. Because if we don't win against the satellite, there's no point in planning anyway. So let's assume we burn it out. What next?"
"The planet," someone said. There was a curious ripple through the room, of hope and dread together.
Karst nodded moodily.
"Yeah. Most of you never saw it, but believe me, it's not going to be an easy place to settle down on, at least at the start. Am I right, Mason?"
Holston started at unexpectedly having his opinion solicited. "But of course, there's just him and me who were down there on the surface."
"You're right,"
he confirmed.
"That's where guns come in, for those that feel they can lower themselves to use them."
Karst, already pre-lowered, winched his grin up a notch.
"Basically, the planet's full of all sorts of beasties, spiders and bugs and all manner of shit. So, while we get ourselves set up, we're going to be burning them out, too. Clearing forest, driving off the wildlife, exterminating anything that looks at us funny. It'll be fun. Frankly, it's the sort of thing I've been looking forward to since I first got aboard. Hard work, though. And everyone works. Remember, we're key crew. Us and the chiefs of the new engineers, like Al here, it's our responsibility. We make this work. Everyone's depending on us. Think about that. When I say everyone, I really mean it. The Gilgamesh is all there is."
He clapped his hands as though that entire speech had reinvigorated him and boosted his personal morale.
"Security team, whoever's got the pad with our new recruits, sort them out and get them armed, teach them which end not to look down. You lot all get to join us on the bug hunt afterwards."
Holston assumed that meant everyone fool enough to say yes when Vitas had asked them if they could use a gun.
"Tribe,"
Cast added, then seemed to lose momentum. I won't bother telling you, as you know what you're doing. Been doing it long enough, anyway. Alpesh, stick close, though. I want you as liaison. Tribe seemed to be the engineers, or those descendants of theirs currently keeping the ship together. The few of them still there now bolted off, with the air of people who had found the entire proceedings boring and unnecessary, but had been aware that they should be on their best behaviour nonetheless, like children during a religious service.
Right, Mason.
Harlan? Holston. Right, Cast nodded, unapologetic. Something special for you, right? You actually get to do your job. The satellite's transmitting all sorts of shit, and you're the only person who might know what it's saying.
Transmitting? To us?
Yes, maybe. Alpesh?
Probably no, the young engineer confirmed.
Anyway, whatever. Take Mason here and plug him in. Mason, if you can make anything out of it, let me know. Personally, I reckon it's just gone mad.
Madder, Holston corrected, and although this hadn't been a joke, Cast laughed.
We're all in the same boat, aren't we?
He said almost fondly, glancing around at the battered confines of the Gilgamesh.
All of us on the same old boat.
The mask slipped, and for a second Holston was looking into the stress fractures and botched job repairs that made up Cast's overstrained soul. The man had always been a follower, and now he was in charge, the last general of the human race facing unknown odds with the highest possible stakes. His somewhat disjointed briefing now looked in retrospect like a man fighting for his composure, and holding on to it, just. Against all expectations, Cast was coping. Come the hour, come the man. Also, he might be drunk. Holston realised he couldn't tell. Alpesh led him to a console, still acting as though Holston and Cast and the rest were heroes of legend brought to life, but turning out to be somewhat disappointing in the flesh. Holston wondered, with a professional curiosity, whether some crazy myth cycle had grown up amongst the tribe, with himself and the rest of Key Crew as a pantheon of fractious gods, trickster heroes and monsters. He had no idea how many generations had gone by since their last actual contact with anyone not born on the Gilgamesh. Since he had been about to ask, but a piece clicked into place and he knew that he wouldn't ask. Not now. Not when he had thought of Lane at last. For Lane must have died long, long ago. Had she thought of him at the end? Had she come to look into the cold stillness of his coffin? Her sleeping prince, who she had never permitted to come back for her? Alpesh gave a nervous cough, picking up on Holston's suddenly changed mood. The classicist scowled, waved off the man's concern.
Tell me about these transmissions.
With a worried look, Alpesh turned to the console. The machinery looked battered, something that had been taken apart and put back together more than once. There was some sort of symbol and some graffiti stenciled on the side, which looked new. Holston stared at it for a moment before disentangling the words. Do not open. No user serviceable parts inside. He laughed, thinking that he saw the joke, the sort of bleak humour that he recalled engineers resorting to in extremis. There was nothing on Alpash's face to suggest that he saw any humour in it, though, or that the slogan was anything other than a sacred symbol of the tribe. Abruptly, Holston felt bitter and sick again. He felt like Cast must feel. He was just a thing of the lost past, trying to recapture an almost lost future.
There's a lot of it, Alpesh explained. It's constant, on multiple frequencies. We can't understand any of it. I don't know what this Avranakern is, but I think the commander may be right. It sounds like madness. It's like the planet is whispering to itself.
The planet? Holston queried.
We're not getting these signals direct from the satellite, as far as we can understand.
Now that Alpesh began speaking more, Holston heard unfamiliar rhythms and inflections in his words. A little of Lane, a little of the Gilgamesh's automatic systems, a little of something new. There was obviously a shipborne accent now. Alpesh brought up a numerical display that was apparently intended to be educational.
You can see here what we can tell from the transmissions.
Holston was used to the Gilgamesh sugarcoating that sort of data in a form that a layman could understand,
but that concession was apparently not something the tribe felt it needed. Seeing his blank look, the engineer went on.
Our best bet is that these are transmissions being directed at the planet, just like the original numerical sequence, and we're now catching bounce back. They're definitely coming to us by way of the planet, though.
You've had other classicists working on this, out of cargo? There must be a few students, or...
Alpash looked solemn. I'm afraid not. We have searched the manifest. There were only a very few at the start. You are the last.
Holston stared at him for a long while, thinking through the implications of that, thinking about Earth's long history before the fall, before the ice came. His society had possessed such a fragmented, imperfect understanding of the predecessors that they were constantly trying to ape. And did even that poor record now boil down to just himself? The contents of one old man's head? All that history. And if, when, I die? He did not see anyone having time to attend history classes in Karst's survivalist Eden. He shivered. Not from the usual human sense of mortality, but from a feeling of vast, invisible things falling away into oblivion, irretrievable and irreplaceable. Grimly he turned to the messages that Alpash was now showing him. After some work, Holston finally deciphered the display enough to register just how many of the recordings there were, and these presumably just a fraction of the total. What's Kern playing at? Maybe she has gone off the deep end, after all. He accessed one, but it wasn't anything like the other transmissions from the satellite which he remembered. Still, Holston felt long unused academic parts of his brain try to sit up and take notice, seeing complexity, repeated patterns. He performed whatever analysis and modelling the console allowed him. This wasn't random static. But nor was it the old Empire messages that Kern, Eliza, had used previously. Perhaps it's encrypted, he mused to himself.
There's a second type as well, Alpash explained. This is how the majority go, but there are some that seem different, here.
Holston listened to the chosen recording, another sequence of pulses, but this time seeming closer to what he would actually recognize as a message.
Just this, though? No distress signal? No number sequences?
This, and as much of this as you could want, Alpash confirmed. How much time do we have before things start?
At least 30 hours.
Holston nodded. Can I get something to eat?
Of course.
Then leave me with this and I'll see if I can find anything in it for Karst.
Alpash moved to go, and for a moment Holston was going to stop him. To ask him that impossible question that historians can never ask regarding the things they study. What is it like to be you? A question nobody can step far enough out of their own frame of reference to answer. With some help from the tribe, he was able to hunt through the Gilgamesh's systems for at least some of his electronic toolkit to try and unpick the messages. He was given what he wanted, then left alone to work. He had a sense that, across the ship, a great many shipborn and woken were bracing themselves for the moment their lives had been leading up to for generations, and during sleeping centuries, respectively. He was happy to be out of it. Here, at this failing end of time, the classicist Holston Mason was glad to be poring over some incomprehensible transmissions in a futile search for meaning. He was not Karst, nor was he Alpash. Or his kin. Old. I'm old. In so many ways. Old, and yet still lively enough that he was even going to outlive the Ark ship itself, by the look of things. He realized he could make nothing out of the majority of the messages. They were generally faint, and he guessed that they were being sent from the planet in all directions, just radiating out into space. Rather, bounced off the planet. Not sent. Of course not sent. He blinked, obscurely uncomfortable. Whatever their source, though, they were sufficiently far from anything he knew that he could not even be sure that they were messages, couched in any kind of code or language. Only a stubborn streak of structure to them,
convinced him that they were not some natural interference or just white noise. The others, though, they were stronger, and recent analysis conducted by the tribe suggested that they might actually be targeted towards the Gilgamesh's line of approach, as though Kern was using the planet as a sounding board to rant incomprehensibly at them. Or the planet itself was shouting at them. Or the planet was shouting? Halston rubbed at his eyes. He had been working for too long. He was beginning to come adrift from rational speculation. These transmissions, though, at first he had thought they were as much babble as the rest, but he had cross-referenced them with some old stored records of messages from the satellite and tried to treat them in the same way, varying the encoding by trial and error until something like a message had abruptly sprung out from the white noise. There had been words, or at least he had fooled himself that he had decoded words there. Imperial Sea words, words out of history, the dead language given new and mutated life. He thought again about Alpash's accent. These transmissions seemed almost as if someone out there was speaking some barbarous version of that ancient language, encoded just as Kern encoded her transmissions, some degraded or evolved or simply corrupted attempt at the ancient tongue. It was proper historian work just poring over it. He could almost forget the trouble they were all in and pretend he was on the brink of some great discovery that anyone would care about. What if this isn't just the crazed gibberish of a dying computer? What if this means something? If it was Kern trying to talk to them, though, then she had obviously lost most of what she was. The woman machine that Halston remembered had no difficulty in making herself understood. So what was she trying to say now? The more he listened to the clearest of those decoded transmissions, those sent directly along the line of the Gilgamesh's approach, the more he felt that someone was trying to speak to him, across millions of kilometres, and across a gap of comprehension that was far greater. He could even fool himself that little snippets of phrasing were coming together into something resembling a coherent message. Stay away. We do not wish to fight. Go back. Halston stared at what he had. Am I just imagining this? None of it had been clear. The transmission was in poor shape and nothing about it fitted in with Kern's earlier behaviour. The more he looked, though, the more he became sure that this was a message and that it was intended specifically for them. They were being warned off again, as though by dozens of different voices. Even in those sections he could not disentangle, he could pick out individual words. Leave. Peace. Alone. Death. He wondered what he could possibly tell Karst. He slept on it for a while in the end, and then shambled off to find the acting commander in the comms room.
"You're cutting it fine," Karst told him. "I launched the drones hours back. I calculate about 2 hours before they do what they do, if it can be done at all."
"Burning Kern?"
"Fucking right."
Karst stared at the working screens surrounding him with haunted, desperate eyes that belied the easy grin he kept trying to keep pinned on his face.
"Come on then, Halston. Out with it."
"Well, it's a message and it's intended for us. That much I'm reasonably certain about."
"Reasonably certain? Fucking academics."
But it was almost good-natured, even so.
"So Kern's down to basically bombarding us with baby talk, wanting us to go away."
"I can't translate most of it, but those pieces that make any sense at all seem to be consistently along that theme," Halston confirmed. In fact, he was feeling unhappy about his own efforts, as though in this, the last professional challenge of his career, he had made some student-level error and failed. The transmissions had been in front of him, a large body of material to cross-reference, and he had constantly felt on the edge of a breakthrough that would make it all crystal clear to him. It had never come, though, and now there was no time to go back to it. He felt that he had shackled himself too much to the way the old Empire did things, just as everyone always had. If he had come to those transmissions with more of an open mind, rather than trying to recast them in the shape of Kern's earlier work, what might he have found?
"Well, fucker," was Karst's informed opinion. "We're not going anywhere. We don't have that option anymore. It all comes down to this, just like it was always going to. Am I right?
You are, Holston replied hollowly.
Are we getting anything from the drones?
I don't want them transmitting anything until they're close enough to actually get to work, Cast said. Believe me, I remember what fucking Kern can do. You weren't in that shuttle when she just took the whole thing over, remember? Just drifting in space with nothing but life support while she worked out what she wanted to do with us. That was no fun at all, believe me.
And yet she let you come down and pick us up, Holston recalled. He thought Cast might come back at him angrily for that, accuse him of going soft, but the security chief's face took on a thoughtful air.
I know, he admitted. And if I thought that there was any chance... But she's not going to let us on that planet, Holston. We tried that one, over and over. She's going to sit there and hoard the last chance for the human race, and let us all die out in space.
Holston nodded. His mind was full of that planet balefully whispering for them to go away.
Can I send from the ship? It might even take her attention from the drones. I don't know.
No, complete silence from us. If she's so crazy that she hasn't seen us, I don't want you cluing her in.
Cast could not keep still. He checked with his seconds in security. He checked with the senior members, chiefs, of the tribe. He paced and fretted, and tried to get some passive data on the drone's progress without running the risk of alerting Kern.
You really think she won't see them coming?
Holston objected.
Who can know? She's old, Holston, really old, older than us by a long way. She was crazy before. Maybe she's gone completely mad now. I'm not giving her anything more than I have to. We get one shot at this before it's down to the girl itself. Literally one shot. Seriously, you know how much power a decent laser takes up? Believe me, those are our two best functioning drones, fucking patchwork jobs from all the working bits we could find.
He clenched his fists, fighting against the weight of his responsibilities.
Everything's falling apart, Holston. We've got to get onto that planet. The ship's dying. That stupid moon base thing of Guyan's, that died. Earth?
I know. Holston hunted about for some sort of reassurance, but he honestly couldn't think of anything to say.
Chief, interrupted one of the tribe. Transmissions from one of the drones coming in. They're coming up on the planet, ready to deploy. At last! Cast practically shouted, and stared about him. Which screen's best? Which is working?
Four screens flared with the new images, one flickering and dying, but the other three holding steady. They saw that familiar green orb, a thing of dreams, the promised land. The drones were following their path towards the satellite's orbital track, darting in to intercept it and bring an end to it. They didn't care about what they were seeing, unlike the human eyes now watching vicariously through their lenses. Cast's mouth hung open. At this moment, even the ability to curse seemed to have deserted him. He fumbled backwards for a seat, and then sat down heavily. Everyone in comms had stopped work, instead staring at the screen, at what had been done to their paradise. Kern's satellite was not alone in its vigil. Around the circumference of the planet, girdling its equator in a broad ring, was a vast band of tangled lines and strands and nodes. Not satellites, but a whole orbiting network, interconnected and continuous around the entire world. It flared bright in the sunlight, opening green petals towards the system's star. There were 1,000 irregular nodes pulled into taut, angular shapes by their connecting conduits. There was a bustle to it, of constant activity. It was a web. It was as though some unthinkable horror had begun the job of cocooning the planet before it fed on it. It was a single, vast web in geostationary orbit about the planet, and Kern's metal home was just one pinpoint within its myriad complexity. Holston thought about those 1,000 transmissions from Kern's world, but not from Kern herself. He thought about those hateful whispers telling the Gilgamesh, impossibly, to turn around and go away, abandon hope, all ye who enter. The drones were arrowing in now, still seeking out Kern's satellite, because their programming had somehow not prepared them for this.
"Spiders," said Karst slowly.
His eyes were roving around, seeking desperately for inspiration.
"It's not possible."
There was a pleading edge to his voice. Holston just stared at that vast snare laid around the planet, seeing more detail every second as the drones closed with it. He saw things moving across it, shuttling back and forth. He saw long strands reaching out into space from it as though hungry for more prey. He thought he saw other lines reaching down towards the planet itself. His skin was crawling, and he remembered his brief stay on the planet, the deaths of the mutineers.
"No," said Karst flatly, and "no," again. "It's ours. It's ours. We need it. I don't care what the fuck the bastards have done with it. We've nowhere else to go."
"What are you going to do?" Holston asked faintly.
"We are going to fight,"
Karst stated, and his sense of purpose returned with those words.
"We are going to fight Kern, and we are going to fight that. We are coming home. You hear me? That's home now. It's all the home we'll ever have. And we will mass drive the fucking place from orbit if we have to make it ours. We'll burn them out. We'll burn them all out. What else have we got?"
He rubbed at his face. When he took his hands away, he seemed composed.
"Right. I need more minds on this. Alpash, it's time."
The engineer nodded.
"Time for what?" Holston demanded. "Time to wake up Lane,"
Karst replied. Chapter 7.2 What Rough Beast. Far beyond the physical tendrils with which they have ringed their planet, the spiders have extended a wider web. Biotechnological receptors in the cold of space hear radio messages, await the return of soundless calls into the void, and reach out for disturbances in gravity and the electromagnetic spectrum. The tremors on the strands that will let them know when a guest has arrived in their parlour. They have been preparing for this day for many generations. The entire planet has, ever since they finally bridged that gap with God, fingertip to leg tip. Their entire civilization has come together with a purpose, and that purpose is survival. The messenger had forever been trying to prepare them, to mould them into her image and give them the weapons she thought they needed in order to fight back. Only when she stopped treating them like children, like monkeys, was she able to do what perhaps she should have done from the start, communicate the problem to them, let them find a solution that was within the reach of their minds and their technology. One advantage of God ceasing to move in mysterious ways is that the entire planet has found a hitherto unknown unity. Little focuses the collective mind more decisively than the threat of utter extinction. The messenger was unstinting in her assurances that the spiders would have nothing else to look forward to if the Gilgamesh was allowed to return unopposed. She had racked her piecemeal recollection of her species' history and found only a hierarchy of destruction, of her species devastating the fauna of planet Earth, and then turning on its own sibling offshoots, and then at last, when no other suitable adversaries remained, tearing at itself. "Mankind brooks no competitors," she has explained to them, "not even its own reflection." For generations, then, a political unity of the spider cities has worked towards creating this vast orbital presence, using all the tools available. The spiders have entered the space age with desperate vigour. And Bianca looks up at the darkening sky, at the unseen filigree of Great Star Nest, the orbital city, and knows that she would rather this had not come about in her lifetime. The enemy is coming. She has never seen this enemy, but she knows what it looks like. She has sought out ancient understandings, preserved across the centuries, that reach back to a time when her kind faced extinction at the jaws of a much more comprehensible foe. For during their conquest of the ant supercolony, Bianca's species encountered what she now knows as humanity. There were giants in the world, back in those days. She now sees, through the long-gone eyes of a distant ancestor, the captive monster that had fallen from the sky. Not from the messenger, as had been believed, but from this approaching menace. Little did they know, it was a herald of the end. It seems so hard to believe that such a huge, ponderous thing could have been sentient, but apparently it was. More than sentient. Things like that, just as the messenger had once been a thing like that, are the Ur-race, the ancient astronauts responsible for all life that has evolved on Bianca's world. And now they are returning to undo that mistake. Bianca's musings have taken her out of the vast reach of the Seven Trees conurbation and on to the closest anchor point, travelling swiftly by wire in a capsule powered by artificial, photosynthetic, self-sufficient muscle. Now she disembarks, feeling the great open space around her. Most of her world's tropical and temperate land area is still forested, either for agricultural purposes as wild reserves, or serving as the scaffolding that her species use to build their cities. The areas around the elevator anchor points are all kept clear, though, and she sees a great tent of silken walls 100 feet high, culminating in a single point that stretches ever away into the high distance, beyond the ability of her eyes to follow it. She knows where it goes, though, heading up, up out of the planet's atmosphere, then up further and further, as a slender thread that reaches halfway to the arc of the moon. The equator is studded with them. That long-ago balloonist was right. There was an easier way to claw one's way up and out of the planet's gravity well, and into orbit, and all it took was spinning a strong enough thread. Bianca meets with her assistants, a subdued band of 5 females and 2 males, and they hurry inside to another capsule, this one moving by little more than simple mechanical principles utilized on a grand scale. Unimaginably far away is a comparable weight even now descending inwards towards the planet's surface. By exercise of the sort of mathematics that Bianca's species has been fluent in for centuries, Bianca's own car begins its long, long ascent. She is the general, the tactician. She is going to take her place amidst the bustling community known as Great Star Nest, to mastermind the defence of her planet against the alien invaders, the star gods. She has ultimate responsibility for the survival of her species. A great many better minds than hers have formulated the plan that she will attempt to carry out, but it will be her own decisions that will make the difference between success and failure. The journey up is a long one, and Bianca has plenty of time to reflect. The enemy they face is the child of a technology she cannot conceive of, advanced beyond the dreams of her own kind's greatest scientists, using a technology of metal and fire and lighting, all fit tools for vengeful deities. At her disposal is fragile silk, biochemistry and symbiosis, and the valour of all those who will put their lives at her disposal. Fretting, she spins and destroys, as she and her fellows are hauled towards the open darkness of space, and the gleaming grid of her people's greatest architectural triumph. Already in orbit on the globe-spanning 3-dimensional sculpture they think of as Great Star Nest, Portia is steeling herself for a fight. The great equatorial web is studded with habitats that trail out from one another, interconnect, are spun up or taken down. It has become a way of life for the spiders, and one they have taken to remarkably quickly. They are a species that is well made for a life of constant freefall around a planet. They are born to climb and to orient themselves in 3 dimensions. Their rear legs give them a powerful capacity to jump to places that their keen eyes and minds can target precisely, and if they get it wrong, they always have a safety line. In a curious way, as Portia and many others have considered, they were born to live out in space. The old cumbersome spacesuits which once took those pioneering balloonists to the outer reaches of the atmosphere are things of the past now. Portia and her squad traverse the lattice-strung vacuum quickly and efficiently, setting out on manoeuvres to ready themselves for the coming conflict. They carry most of their suit about their abdomens, book lungs fed by an air supply that is chemically generated as needed, rather than stored in tanks. With their training and their technology, and their relatively undemanding metabolisms, they can stay out in raw space for days. A chemical heating pack is secured beneath their bodies, along with a compact radio. A lensed mask protects their eyes and mouths. At the tip of each abdomen, their spinnerets connect to a little silk factory, spinning chemical silk that forms strands, formidably strong strands, in the airless void. Lastly, they have packs of propellant with adjustable nozzles to guide their silent flight in the void. Their exoskeletons have been coated in a transparent film, a single molecule thick, which prevents any decompression or moisture loss without diminishing much in the way of feeling. The tips of their legs are sheathed in insulating articulated sleeves to guard them from heat loss. They are the complete astronaut soldiers. As they cross from line to line, judging each leap,